Lodge and Hopewell Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello, and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is another installment of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comics I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 80s with my family. This week, we're talking about Batman number 341, which was released on August 6th, 1981. And who better to talk with me about this book than the man who wrote it, Jerry Conway. Hi, Jerry. Welcome back to the network.
Hi. How you doing, Bob?
I'm doing great. This is really thrilling to have you here. I love this comic book. I have distinct memories of sitting on the porch in the cabin up in the Poconos and reading this comic. I remember the newsstand that I bought it off of.
Oh,
it's
wow.
It's one of my favorites. It's as I mentioned to you when I mentioned the show, many years ago when I sold my comic book collection, I had something like 15,000 comics.
And
I eventually sold them all, but all the comics I bought on vacation while I was in the Poconos, I saved. So these are the comics that I still have. And so Batman number 341 is part of that collection. It's a really great book. The cover is got this great shot of Batman looking frightened as he faces the ghost of Wayne Manor. And it's drawn by Jim Aparo. And so you can only imagine how great it is because it's
sure.
Jim Aparo. Yeah. it's just fantastic. There are three stories in this book, which is amazing. For 60 cents, what a value. You're getting three separate stories here. The first one is, as I said, called The Ghost of Wayne Mansion, written by Jerry and drawn by Irv Novick and Frank McLaughlin. Two children run out of the abandoned Wayne Manor, screaming in fright and claiming the house is haunted. One of them runs into a police officer and tells his wild tale. The news circles back to Commissioner Gordon, who goes to the Wayne Foundation to ask Bruce Wayne for permission to inspect the house. Bruce doesn't want the Gotham City Police Department accidentally stumbling upon the old Batcave, so he politely denies Gordon's request. Gordon snaps and angrily tells him he is going through with the investigation whether Wayne likes it or not. Meanwhile, Rupert Thorne returns to Gotham City after being locked away in Arkham Asylum for over a year. He reestablishes his position at the Tobacconist Club and tells his fellow members how he intends on putting his own political stooge into the mayor's office. He blackmails the other club members into supporting this scheme. Commissioner Gordon hires famed ghost breaker Dr. Terrence 13 to accompany his officers on an inspection of the manor. Also in attendance is Miss Clum, manager of the Gotham Historical Society, who has been administering to upkeep of the mansion ever since Wayne abandoned it. Batman secretly lives at Wayne Manor and tries to seal off all the known entrances to the Batcave. He detects that someone else has been inhabiting the cave and begins exploring. Suddenly, Man-Bat swoops down out of nowhere and attacks him. Dr. 13 re-enters the Batcave just as Man-Bat grasps Batman by the throat. To be continued. Now, Jerry, I have like a million questions about this comic book and this run of Batman comics that you wrote in particular. I've limited it down to just a couple of thousand. But I do want to lead off with complimenting you because you managed to work in Dr. 13, who is one of the worst characters in DC Comics history.
I
actually like him because to me, he's just such a drip. Like, you know, how anyone can live in the DC universe and not be totally on board with the idea of ghosts and supernatural is beyond me. But I love his use here. It makes total sense that Gordon would call him in.
Sure. I mean, you bring in a Ghostbuster to explain why there's, you know, what's going on in this supposed supernatural situation. But I had my own reasons for wanting to bring in Dr. 13, which was... he was one of the first characters that I had written at DC Comics back when I did my first superhero story, a continuing character story, was a Phantom Stranger. And Dr. 13 was a semi-regular presence in that book. And I always felt that there was something fun about, you know, this complete skeptic, you know, in a book about an actual supernatural hero.
Right.
So the idea of bringing him back, you know, and putting him into this situation just seemed like a natural for me. You know, and I like to do things that are a little unexpected and, you know, kind of fun and also tickle my personal funny bone, which is, you know, what this did.
Yes. One of the hallmarks of your run, and by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, Jerry wrote issues 337 through 359 of the Batman series, is there's a lot of gothic stories in here. I mean, the issue just before this one, where you've got the Mole, which is like one of my, like, I love that issue because it's such an obscure villain, you brought him back. But I mean, you really played up the sort of gothic, dark, mm-hmm. ghosty angle of Batman. Do you remember, like, was that, what was your thought behind
that? Well, there was a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one of the main reasons was when I came onto the book, you'd had all these years of, you know, kind of flailing around with the character, you know, of which way was he going to go? You know, was he going to be the detective? You know, was he going to be the Dark Knight? I mean, I think it was before the Dark Knight, obviously, but Denny O'Neill had played with that aspect of the character in the 70s. And I went back to the original Batman stories from the early 40s, and looked at those as kind of a thematic template, you know, something that I was trying to go for. And those stories were very heavily influenced by gothic type pulp, you know, in addition to the shadow influences. There was this kind of feeling of not supernatural dread, but this aspect of, you know, dreaded mystery as opposed to crime mystery. And I thought that was kind of fun. You know, that's why I brought back characters like the Mole and then Hugo Strange and the like, you know, at least in the initial run that I had on the book.
Yeah, I did want to get into that, because if you go through the list of villains that you wrote during these issues, I mean, you've got there's the character of the Snowman, who was like literally like an abominable snowman. The Sportsman, Poison Ivy, who at the time was not the huge name that she is now. The Mole, Man Bat, of course. The Dagger, Dr. Death, Two-Face, Deadshot, Colonel Blimp, the Joker, Hugo Strange, Catwoman, and Killer Croc, who of course you created. And you know, while you've got a couple of ringers there, you know, the Joker and Two-Face, Catwoman, some of the sort of literal usual suspects, as you mentioned, like, you brought back a lot of really obscure characters.
Yeah,
and I always figured that was something you wanted to do, because these were like, were these characters that you remembered from just reading the comics? Or
no, because most of them were way preceded me. I mean, I don't think Dr. Death or Hugo Strange had been around since the 40s. I mean, if I encountered them at all, it might have been in a reprint story. But I think for the most part, it was just going back to the archives and trying to dig up stuff that hadn't been done to death. I certainly didn't want to go back and do the alien Batman stories or the science fiction Batman stories. And I like the idea of the detective Batman stories. But these were villains that, you know, hadn't had a lot of exposure, and it was an opportunity to, you know, to kind of surprise the reader and hopefully re-embrace some of those old storytelling techniques that hadn't really been tried since the 40s.
When you started out on this run, like, for people who don't know, like, about anything about how comic books are written, or in particular maybe how you do them, like, do you sit out and say, I want to bring back this character? Like, I want to get to Man Bat. Is that a goal, or is it sort of, just started writing the issues?
There are certain characters. I mean, I do tend to go month to month, but there was always a you know, like a mental list of things that I want to at some point, you know, encounter. And some of my favorite characters were characters like Man Bat. You know, you kind of have to do a Joker story and a Catwoman story and a Two-Face story, but there are also these, as I said, when I went back and did this archive research, encountering these characters that I'd never seen, you know, reused, I thought, this is a terrific opportunity, you know, and so I kept them in my pocket for stories, you know, the things that I could use as the basis, springboard for a story.
Right, and for people who don't know, Jerry has a bit of a history with Man-Bat, and that you wrote Man-Bat number one. Yes, everybody, Man-Bat had his own comic book at one point, very briefly.
Two issues, I think, or three.
Two issues. But I, you know, worth noting is that Man-Bat number one was drawn by the now late, unfortunately, great Steve Ditko, which, as far as we know, is the only time he drew Batman is your story.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of that. I mean, there may be an occasion when he did it with an appearance in one of his other DC books, but I don't think so. That was a deliberate act on my part. You know, I mean, I thought obviously he'd be great to do Man-Bat, but the opportunity of seeing Steve Ditko's Batman was too much to pass up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Him, you know, such a famous Marvel artist drawing one of DC's, you know, flagship characters.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole politics angle, I do want to ask you about that. Like, do you remember where you came to that notion? I mean, Steve Englehart had touched on that a little bit in his run with Marshall Rogers. But, of course, any city of Gotham size, and it's supposed to be, you know, a version of New York or Chicago, like that level of size of a city. But did you think that was that kind of something that interested you, of course? Because,
oh, sure.
I mean,
sure.
I'm guessing if you're a bad guy, you know that Batman is going to constantly be stopping you. So why not go the other route and do things officially?
Yeah, exactly. And the other aspect of it is you get a character like Boss Thorne can be a threat to both Bruce Wayne and Batman. And to Commissioner Gordon, and to the entire system, you know, that Batman operates under. So it creates a multifaceted threat. And I also just kind of love writing these kind of very corrupt figures, you know, morally corrupt figures, as opposed to the supervillains who tend to be more driven by some kind of psychosis. A guy who's just simply morally corrupt is kind of fascinating. Right. You know, there's more levels that you can operate on with someone like that.
Right. How does Batman take on a guy like that? He can't just punch the guy. He's got to deal with it in a more... Yeah, absolutely. What was it like working with Irv Novik? He's one of these guys that I just think most fans don't have a great appreciation for, because his style, I think, was pretty... I don't want to say it's not flashy, but it's not flashy. But it's really good and really solid. And I just don't think I think a lot of fans just don't really remember him. But he did Batman for years.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was part of that school of artists that were influenced by Milton Caniff. I think he and Frank Robbins. They were influenced by the newspaper strips of the 40s and 50s. Sure. And I think that was a style that battled the superhero style at the, you know, for a while. You know, you had the artists, mostly at DC, who were aspiring to newspaper strip type storytelling. And even someone like Neil Adams was part of that school, although he incorporated superhero dynamics. I think he was fundamentally of the newspaper artist school of storytelling. And a guy like Novik or a guy like Frank Robbins were cartoony in a sense. You know, they weren't trying to create a realistic environment. And they weren't also trying to create a superhero environment. They were trying to create this kind of naturalistic, heightened naturalism. As I say, this kind of Milton Caniff sort of universe. Terry and the Pirates as opposed to, you know, Jack Kirby. So I was really fascinated to work with him, with Jim Aparo, who had a similar style in a sense. Again, not going full bore superhero. And that kind of worked for Batman in a way that I think we're seeing again, you know, with some of the artists who are coming on the books these days, someone who tries to embrace the less superheroic, more moody, more character-based aspects of that storytelling style.
Did you interact with him a lot? Did you have the opportunity to?
No,
or was it just wrote the stories and off they went?
With Irv, I mean, I interacted with people like Gene Colan more than I would have interacted with Irv. Irv was an old school pro. You know, he took the scripts and drew what you wrote. That was about it. So, but someone like Gene, who I knew from working at Marvel, I could talk to him about, like, what would you like to do? You know, what kind of stories would you like to do? and it was more, you know, more of a personal interaction.
Okay. When you took over the book, I mean, Batman was not, the Batcave was in mothballs. He was working out of the Wayne Foundation building, and during your run, he comes back to the cave, and there's a bunch of stories like this one where it centers around the cave. Was that, do you remember, like, were you kind of itching to get him back to the cave?
Yeah, I felt, you know, I think there was a push to try to urbanize him more than, I mean, it's not urbanized. They were trying to modernize him, you know, in the same way that they tried to modernize Clark Kent, you know, by making him a TV reporter.
Right.
You know, they tried to modernize Bruce Wayne by putting the Batcave under the Wayne Foundation building in effect. I mean, you know, it to me, that seemed kind of silly and unnecessary. You don't have to get rid of Wayne Manor, you know, in order to make him relevant to the modern age. You know, you can play against the Batcave, you can play against the Wayne Manor and still have him be, you know, an active modern character. You don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
So my goal was kind of revanchist, you know, to an extent when I was working on Batman. I wanted to bring back elements of what I felt had been successful with the character for decades that had been lost over the previous 10 years or so. So I would, you know, I brought back Wayne Manor. I introduced Jason Todd, you know, and Robin, you know, tried to do the kinds of stories that I thought worked for the character.
Not to get off this issue, but I this is the only probably opportunity I'm going to have to mention this. In the previous issue, number 340, which I already mentioned, the one with the mole, I don't know if it's you because you're listed as plotter and Roy Thomas is scripter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whose notion this was, but number 340 features one of my favorite Batman gimmicks of all time, where we find out that Batman has a Batman dummy installed in the periphery of the cave that he can operate with a button. And so he can literally point out the window to people and go, look, there's Batman out there. And of course, I'm not Batman because I'm Bruce Wayne in here. I loved how absurd that was. That is one of my favorite things Batman has ever done for his cave. Was that your notion or was that
Roy's? Well, if I plotted it, it's probably my notion. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Oh my God. I fell in love with that whole idea that, like, he has that rigged out there. It's just this Batman dummy to be out there in the rain. Like, oh, look, there's Batman patrolling the manor.
See, you know, it can work, you know.
Oh, I loved it.
And honestly, that's a lift also from Sherlock Holmes, right? You know, which is the idea that I think it was in the Return of Sherlock Holmes or one of them, you know, where somebody shoots in the window to shoot at Holmes and it's a dummy.
So, oh, I didn't even know that. Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. Oh, yeah. That's great. That's great. I was so, how old was I? I guess 10 years old when I read this. As a 10-year-old,
right.
I was just so in love with the idea of a Batman dummy on a winch or something that just pops out of the ground. Oh, it's just fantastic. So, the one last thing I do want to mention about this particular story is there's a sequence where Batman and Alfred go to look at a schematic of Wayne Foundation. Not Wayne Foundation, the Batcave.
Right.
And they start looking at surveillance things, and he sees that the stairway to the grandfather clock is ajar, and that lets him know that, oh, somebody's been there. And it's on page 6 of the story. It's the last panel, and it's Batman and Alfred looking at a view screen. And the view screen shot of the Batcave is literally the same drawing of the Batcave that appeared in the Batman Treasury Edition, Limited Collector's Edition number 37. And there was a bonus feature, a 2-page spread, The Secrets of the Batcave.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, and it is literally the same drawing. They just statted it in. I love it.
Absolutely. I think I asked for that because I love that kind of – that was a perennial thing back when I was first reading the Batman comics in the late 50s, early 60s, and especially the Batman annuals. You would occasionally get these cutaway views of the Batcave, you know, where the Batmobile was located, you know, how it would come up. I mean, at one point it didn't come up through a cave entrance. It came up through a farmhouse, you know,
right,
and they'd
right.
show the winch, you know, and how it would come up and – I loved all that stuff. It was the idea that you could diagram these things, and then they would it would supposedly be the actual layout, you know. When it, but none of it would work, you know. It would look great. I just loved it.
I love the idea, again, that there was somebody at the D.C. bullpen that had to go out and find that stat and, like, you know, get, shoot it and put it in. When I was rereading the comic book, I was like, boy, that looks a lot like the stat. And then I went and dug out the treasury and I go, it's the exact same thing. Oh, I was so excited. It was so cool. Very cool. So this is a really fun story. I love Man-Bat. He was one of my favorite characters, so I love that you worked him in. And it's a great cliffhanger ending to see him and the grip, Batman in the grips of Man-Bat. This is fantastic. The second story is just a little two-page mystery called Murder Will Out by Robin Snyder and Adrian Gonzalez. And it's Batman helps Commissioner Gordon solved a locked room murder. Now, of course, you didn't write this, but I am curious, were these things done, these little two-pagers or one-pager, were they sort of done as inventory stories that they could drop in at a moment's notice, or was this planned?
I don't know. This was during the period where they were trying different size formats, right? So there was probably a feeling that, well, if this doesn't work, we can't, you know, we have to plan for this failing. So we have to have stories that can be complete in a normal, quote, normal size page count. So therefore, you'd have to have these little interstitial stories that could be thrown in. And it's an opportunity to give people work to start them out, you know, to see how they do. I would guess that would have been the thinking on it. But I'm just speculating.
Okay, but I mean, you were always contracted to write, like, say, a 17-page Batman story, not a 19-page or something.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Because a 17-pager would have been then able to be published in a 25-cent or 35-cent comic or whatever the
makes sense.
Count was. Yeah.
All right, and then they said there's a third feature, which is the Robin backup strip, and this story is called Night of the Coven, again by Jerry, and the really interesting art team of Trevor Van Eeden and Mike DiCarlo, and more on that in a second. After Robin's short tenure at Hill Circus, Dick Grayson decides it's time to return to Gotham. He hitchhikes his way back and accepts a ride from a bizarre, scarred man named Sharky. Suspecting something odd about Sharky, Dick investigates the man, and he soon discovers that he is the leader of a satanic coven about to perform a human sacrifice. Dick changes into his Robin costume and tries to stop the coven before they murder a young woman, but he is discovered and knocked unconscious by one of the cultists. And again, that is to be continued. Now, you wrote this. Now, again, was this eventually these, you know, Robin does return to Gotham City. So these stories sort of dovetail. Was that always the plan?
Yeah, I think it was to eventually get him back to Gotham City so I could do the Batman Robin stories again. But I think that I'd have to do some research to make sure of this. But this was also kind of in a response to the satanic cult hysteria that was going on.
I was going to ask
in the early 80s. I think that's
pop culture. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know that was part of it. I liked doing Robin stories, mystery stories, and weird mystical things. Again, it sort of fits into that gothic dread type of vibe that I was going for.
Yeah, it's a terrific story. It's very moody. As I said, Trevor Van Eeden and Mike DiCarlo, that is not a team you would think to put together, because Van Eeden is very loose and scratchy, and DiCarlo is, to me, very sort of chiseled and very firm. And yet, to me, it really works. It kind of, for some people that are not fans of Van Eeden's looser work, this really kind of like centers it a little and mm-hmm. makes it a little firmer, but it still has that movement and dynamic sort of storytelling. So I think it's a really great combo.
Well, Trevor, I think at that point in his career was fairly heavily influenced by Neil Adams. I mean, as far as I'm not saying that with 100% confidence, but the combination of the two of them sort of gives you a Neil Adams-esque look, I think, which worked pretty well for Robin, because that was still an influence on the readership. You know, it was that Batman, Neil Adams Batman was still, like, by 1980, still the goalpost, you know, that everybody was trying to achieve. In the way that when Frank Miller came along, that then became the look, you know. But at least at that point, Neil was the Batman god.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a terrific story. I'm a sucker for anything about, like, cults or, like, murderous towns. And as you mentioned, like, that was so much in the culture. I mean, from films, you've got Rosemary's Baby and The Omen and Race with the Devil. I mean, it was all sorts of movies and books about cults. So anytime the hero stumbles into, like, a cult thing, I'm like, oh, boy, this was just terrific. So it's a really good story. And I don't know if you remember, because I remember the idea behind these backups was DC raised their prices from, I think, 50 cents to 60 cents. And their big ad campaign was, well, yeah, we're charging more, but now we're going to give you backup features. And they ran these big two-page spreads saying, you know, well, now in the back of Action Comics is Aquaman, and now in the back of this is Deadman, and in the back of Batman is Robin. Do you remember, like, was Robin always going to be the backup here? I mean, it makes sense, of course, that it would be Robin.
I don't think there was any other candidate that they thought of.
Okay.
I mean, at that time, the female characters that you might put in there today, you know, weren't getting as much play. So, you know, we wouldn't have thought to put Batgirl in or Batwoman. You know, Batman and Robin were your basic team. So it was a way of creating that team without actually going all the way and making it the team as it would later be.
Right. Well, like I said, it's a really terrific comic book.
Again,
for 60 cents, I mean, you get three really fun stories, and they're all very different from one another, which is great. And as I said, I still remember the newsstand that I bought it off of, and I remember sitting on the porch and reading it, and I just read it over and over and over, because, as I mentioned on previous episodes, at this cabin that we were at, we didn't have a television. I mean, by choice. It was the radio and reading, and I read every comic book I could get my hands on, and so that's why these comics are, like, so beloved to me. And this is just one of these books that I will just always cherish. I mean, I'm 47 now, and as my memories fade of things from a couple of years ago, I still can remember being 10 and sitting on the porch reading this book. So it's really one of my favorites.
I feel the same way about a Flash comic that I read at summer camp when I was about 10 years old. So the 10 years old is a good year to latch onto these things. So, and I can still vividly remember the image of, you know, Barry Allen as drawn by Carmen Infantino walking along, and then suddenly having to turn into the Flash. And I think it was like Flash number 107 or something like that. So very, you know, these things stick with you.
Amazing. So this is, for anyone who hasn't read these books, this is a really great run that Jerry had on Batman. They're really interesting stories. As we mentioned, he hits all the big ones. You know, you've got Joker, you've got Two-Face, you've got Catwoman, but you have all these other obscure characters and just different kinds of stories. It's a really fine collection of comics, and I don't know offhand if they've been collected. Do you know if they've been traded at this point?
Well, they've started doing these this Batman by Jerry Conway books, you know, among their visionary books or whatever.
Right, right.
And I think the first volume may even have that issue in it. I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll have to check that out, and I'll put that link in the show notes if it's on.
And they may also be available on Comixology, which is a kind of a go-to place for old comics if you want to read them.
Yeah, if you want to read some really fun Batman stories, everybody check out this run. This is really, really good stuff. So that's really going to do it. Jerry, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, as I said to J.M. DeMatteis when he was on the show last year, if someone had told the 10-year-old me as I read these comics on the porch that, you know, someday you're going to get to talk to the guy that wrote this, I would have, get the hell out of here. That's impossible. those people are living in some Mount Olympus somewhere. That doesn't, you know. So it's a real honor to get to talk to you about this particular book, just because it means so much to me. So thank you for coming on.
By the way, let me just quickly tell you, I just looked on Comixology, and yes, it is available. So
perfect.
For $1.99, you can read that story.
Oh, can't be beat. Everybody do that. Everybody go there and check it out. It cannot be beat. It's really, really great comics. So again, Jerry, thank you so much. And where can people find you on the internet so they want to see what you're working on next?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. It's just Jerry Conway. And I also have a Tumblr, which is also Jerry Conway. So you're welcome to check me out.
Cool. Again, we'll have those links in the show notes. So, again, thanks everybody for listening. Again, Jerry, thanks so much. This is just such a thrill. And like I said, we are gonna hang out here at the cabin and read some more Batman comics and have some sodas and whatnot. And we will see you later. Bye.
Bye.
Betty Davis eyes, and she teased you.